My question was, in light of what you just said, what other options do you see as viable for the workers of Eastern Europe, aside from taking the advice and or financial aid of the West?
Well, the financial, my own answer is the financial aid of the West is not going to go to Eastern Europe. There are two reasons for this. One of them is that the West doesn't actually have aid to give. I mean, one of the great things about the G7 talks is that they spent a great deal of time saying, shall we give money to Russia, shall we do this, shall we not? The reality is that they don't actually have the money to give. America's got the biggest trade deficit. It's facing one of the most mighty recessions that it has ever faced. And this notion of America as some kind of imperial benefactor is absolute nonsense. They just can't afford to do it. They couldn't even afford to pay for the Gulf War. But let's deal with your specific question of what the workers themselves can do. It's not the workers who are ever going to be the beneficiaries of this aid. The first thing is that the workers of Eastern Europe have actually been very sensible in many cases in not playing along with all of the wilder free market schemes of their governments. And a lot of this, of course, is not now reported. Let me give you two or three examples. In Hungary, there have now been three general strikes because of the increase in petrol prices, because of the refusal of the government to acknowledge that real wages are falling and families are in destitution. Those general strikes were organised democratically. They were not organised by unions which were controlled by the bosses, as they used to be controlled. And that's one lesson they've got to learn. They've got to learn how to defend themselves. So the lesson of trade unionism is the most fundamental defensive weapon of the working class. And trade unions can only ever be effective when they are democratically organised. And that's one thing. The second important thing that the workers in Eastern Europe have got to learn is that they aren't going to get anywhere on their own. That they have to build the links with the workers not only in Western Europe, but indeed across the rest of the world. And those links are ones which the initiative has to come from the West to a very great extent in founding. And again, they are starting to happen just this afternoon. I was reading a report of Canadian automobile workers who have been over in Russia, in this particular case, studying the situation in car factories there, giving information to workers about what they should tolerate and what they should not tolerate in terms of working conditions. Because you may or may not know that the level of industrial fatalities inside Russia today is higher than, indeed, most so-called third world countries. Indeed, there are more Russian workers killed every single year in industry than were killed in the entire course of the Afghanistan war. It is an absolute tragedy. So those are the kind of lessons that need to be learned. The most important lesson that needs to be learned is a lesson of political organisation. Now, there is a difficulty, and I would be dishonest if I didn't admit to this difficulty. Socialism is a very dirty word inside Eastern Europe. I mentioned this in an article in the Socialist Standard, and I can mention it to you now, that when the Russian newspaper, which at the time was one of the more democratic newspapers, called Argumenti Facti, Arguments and Facts, asked me to do an article about what's left of what's the role of Marxism, of socialism now, I wrote a thing which was called Socialism Without Bolshevism. And I submitted it to the editor, and I got a phone call, and he said, well, look, we'll publish this, but we can't publish that title. And I said, why? Would it be insulting to talk about the end of Bolshevism? No, they said it would be insulting to talk about socialism. Most people just wouldn't read it. And I can understand that. I can understand that. I think it's the same kind of feeling that many of us feel, that kind of emptiness in our stomachs that we feel, when people talk to us about freedom. Freedom is a very hollow and somewhat insulting catchphrase in the West. And many of us actually are rather disgusted when we hear people appealing to us to do certain things in the name of freedom. And I think that's how they feel about the word socialism. I think perhaps we have to think very carefully about that and about the linguistics of politics. Having said that, what we do have to do is to build within Eastern Europe, amongst East European workers, an awareness that they are living under a capitalist system, that the working class are the people who are keeping that system standing, that it's the working class who are being bled for profits and robbed for profits, and that it's a working class who can democratically remove it by organising themselves into a conscious and democratic political movement for real socialism, whatever they may decide to call it. And that is a particular advice that our political party can and will play, give in this context. That's the advice we can give. We can't give advice about how to organise economies in Eastern Europe. That's not our business. We're not interested in running capital. We're not interested in trying to show workers how to get a better deal out of capitalism, because that is actually trying to teach slaves how to get a better lashing from the master's whip. We're not interested in that. We're interested in taking away the masters, in producing a society where there is not capitalism in Eastern Europe. To do that, we need democratic, revolutionary, socialist parties all over Eastern Europe. Even if they're very small, so if they're very small, they're still much larger than us. Even if they're very small, they've got to be set up, they've got to be active, they've got to be putting their ideas, and their ideas will be seen to be correct. Because as time goes on, what the workers of Eastern Europe are going to discover is that what last year looked like the utopia of the free world looks increasingly like a nightmare of the marketplace.
Yes?
I'd like to ask you one question with two parts. First of all, do you think that socialism will be achieved in the lifetime of anyone in this room? And the second part, do you think that socialism can be achieved only by education alone, or do you think there have to be some kind of struggle? First of all, bearing in mind, even in the capitalist system, we know that the suffragette movement and other movements committed, shall we say, civil disobedience to achieve the votes for women. Also, more recently, certain left-wing parties, socialist workers among them, who may or may not really be socialist, but they have had some effect in influencing events to do with the poll tax.
Well, it'll be achieved in your lifetime, but not in mine. I've got an exact date on my calendar at home. If you would have asked me, I'd have brought it, and I could have told you. Then you could have planned your lifestyle. But look, there's an answer. When will socialism be established? I'm a socialist because I want socialism in my lifetime. I'm not a socialist because I'm thinking about distant generations a long way ahead. I don't think, actually, that people can be motivated by that kind of philosophy, incidentally. I think people who are motivated by the philosophy of acting in a certain way when they live, so that beyond the grave they're going to go to heaven or not go to hell, are very odd kind of people. And people who imagine that politics is about what's going to happen in the distant future, that's a nice dream. That's not what it's about as far as I'm concerned. I don't think we get very far if that's what it is about for it. As far as we're concerned, one of the many lessons that came out of what happened in Eastern Europe was just how rapid political change can be. And, you know, if you would have gone to Czechoslovakia in 1985 and stood in the middle of Prague and said, within 5 years from now, this whole bloody regime is going to be gone, they'd have called you a utopian, a lunatic, a dreamer, a madman. I said, no, not in our lifetime. And it happened. And change can happen very fast indeed. And I happen to think, both in terms of my own lifetime and in terms of historical experience, that we are probably living at one of the most momentously dynamic moments in history that there has actually ever been, certainly this century. I can't think of any time when there were so many potentials for change all working themselves out, when there was the massive opportunity to remake the world, because the world appears to be remaking itself. So, if you're a socialist, you're not a socialist on the basis of blind optimism, but you have to be a socialist on the basis of assuming that history is something that we make, and history is not something which is written out in a book for us to wait to happen. Let's come to the second part of your question, because that's a much more important part. Is socialism going to come about by education alone? Because it's not. Socialism is not going to come about as a result of, you know, these meetings getting larger and larger and larger. Eventually we take up the whole of Camden High Street, then we're down to Mornington Crescent, then we're down to Islington, and then the government doesn't know what to do. It's such a big, big public meeting. It's all right, I'm still speaking, they can hear me at the back. But you see, it's a problem. It's not going to happen like that. Socialism is not going to come about because one day they say, incidentally, we've had an increase of the socialist standard print run. We're producing 3 billion this week. It's not going to happen like that. Socialism is, of course, it's always been, all historical change is a product of the relationship between ideas and the struggle to exist in the society around us. But let me, if I may, caution you about this. Don't make a contradiction and an opposition between what you call education and what you call struggle. Because education is struggle. Ideas are part of the process of being involved in that daily experience. Every one of us in this room who is a socialist, or is thinking of becoming a socialist, or indeed who is an anti-socialist, is so because of things that have happened to us. Because of fights we've had to get in, because of miseries we've had to endure, because of things that we've seen around us which we can't bear to see anymore and we want to change them. That's what makes us socialists. So it's a product of that struggle. And then you say, well, look, let's take specific examples of action that's been taken, for example, by women in the course of getting the vote, or by workers in the course of getting rid of the poll tax. And I put the answer to you this way. You see, the movement for reform is something which capitalism can always give in to. Capitalism, in a sense, is quite happy when workers are asking for changes within the system. Because that is an admission that the system itself is going to carry on. I would put it to you that when workers were fighting out on the streets over the poll tax, that was not regarded by the government or by people of power in capitalist society as a serious threat to their power. In fact, what they actually decided was that Thatcher, in a rather disorganized and historically irrelevant policies, were not suitable for the continuation of their power, and they got rid of her. And they replaced her with the blow-up doll, Major. And when you look at these changes, one of the things that's clear is that socialism will only come about when the explosions and the struggles are starting out here in the most important weapon that the working class possess, and that's a brain. Now, I remember at the time of the Brixton riots and the Toxteth riots, speaking on the outdoor platform in London, and people coming along and saying, people involved in those riots showed what it was all about. They didn't show anything. What those riots demonstrated was that workers were angry. You don't need a riot to see that workers are angry. All you need to do is to go on the underground at 9 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock at night. All you need to do is to talk to anyone who lives in your street, who drinks in your pub, who works with you. You'll know that they're angry. You'll know that they're discontented. And if you loot a few shops, and at the time of the Brixton riots, you know, they looted a few shops. They didn't even loot the shops in Bond Street. They looted the bloody shops in Brixton. And there's nothing worth taking. The only thing they left in the window was what was it at the time? The Charles and Di wedding models. They were all left, apparently, and everything else was taken. It wasn't worth having. It's all broken by now. The reality is that when you have a socialist movement, that socialist movement has to take a democratic form. And when it takes a democratic form, that is what the ruling class are actually very scared of. They are scared of discussion, they are scared of articulate workers, they are scared of thoughtful workers, they are scared of people who understand history, who know where they've been, who know exactly where the bloodstains are on their hands. That's what they're scared of. That's what they're scared of. And so that's a way that fight has to be pursued. Final point, you ask, well, hang on, will this be a violent armed struggle? No. Armed struggle is the weapon of minorities. Armed struggle is the way that the capitalist class get power. That's the way they got power in this country, it's the way they got power in France, it's the way they got power in America, it's the way they get power everywhere. It's by shooting. The gun is the friend of the capitalists. They like bombs, they like armies, they like military academies at Sandhurst where they can train people to be psychopaths. We don't need that. What we want are workers who understand the respect for other human beings sufficiently to say, we're not going to kill anyone. But on the other hand, when a majority of workers decide that it's time for socialism and the world is going to be ours, no one is going to stop us. And it won't be an armed struggle. Because when a majority of workers say it's time for socialism, and Prince Philip and Prince Charles come hobbling down the road with their hockey sticks and waving their arms in the air and saying, you can't have it, it belongs to us, I don't think it'll be an armed struggle. I think it'll be what's common, you call it kicking the bollocks. And that'll be the end of it. That'll be the armed struggle, beginning, end. Take about 15 minutes, I'll be there. Don't worry about that. We're not talking about a violent revolution. Because in fact, the working class are the overwhelming majority. You take all of the working class, you put them on this side of the world, you take all of the capitalist class and you put them on that side of the world, if the workers spat at the capitalists, we'd drown a lot of them.
That's true. Thank you, Colin. Thank you for collection £26.09. The back.
Continue on the question this young lady brought up, I will say as a side, I'm probably one of the oldest in this room, and I'm optimistic. That's why I think of the hallmark of any revolution. But I remember seeing a film of the the coal miners on strike in the Ukraine. And one of the things they said there was that we would run this mine ourselves, that the people who work in the mines know those mines better, how to work in those mines better than anybody else. We do not need a bureaucrat from Moscow to do this. My question is, in light of the fact that Marxist literature, even though distorted by the bureaucrats, has been available to most workers, I would presume, in the Soviet Union, would you think that maybe with some prodding that eventually that they will come around to see the absolute bankruptcy, so-called aid from the West, because as you say, they are bankrupt, that they will take it into their own hands?
Thank you.
I think the problem is actually that Marxist literature has not on the whole been disseminated to workers in the Russian Empire and in Eastern Europe. I wish in many ways that were true, and I see the logic of what you're saying. Actually, one of the things that always interested me when I talked to workers in Russia is just how unfamiliar they are with Marx. The only thing they know about Marx is that they had a big picture of him at the front of their schoolroom, and occasionally would catch a sight of his left eye as they were getting a whack around the arse. So, generally speaking, you know, that was the closest they came to Karl Marx in the course of their school years. But I think there is this, that you see, in many respects, the best way to see Eastern Europe is in terms of the way that the Britain and the rest of Europe were in probably even the early part of last century, of the last century, when trade unions, there had been no experience of trade unions, when it had been illegal to assemble, illegal to publish literature, and it's worth remembering, it was a conservative government in this country which actually made all of these things illegal. It was a Lord Liverpool's government in the second decade of the last century who outlawed trade unions, who made it illegal to have meetings like this. It was illegal for more than six people to gather in one room. It was illegal to publish any political literature. These were called the gag acts. They were designed to gag the working class. Very important to remember that. It's very important to remember that before the workers in Poland and the workers in Russia had to go out in the streets and quite rightly demand their right to assemble, that here in Manchester, in this country, there were 13 men, women and children who were killed at the gathering at St. Peter's Square in Manchester, simply because they wanted to stand up and hear a public speaker. It's worth remembering that in Hyde Park in London, as late as 1866, the police surrounded speakers, what is now Speaker's Corner, with batons, and they actually killed a man in the course of preventing a demonstration from taking place. And it was only as a result of the workers breaking down the railings and speaking this took place. What I'm saying is, of course, and it comes back to your point, you learn through experience, don't you? You learn through having to engage in these struggles, through having to assert what you want. But the workers of Eastern Europe, I think, are going to learn much faster for two reasons. One is that what's happening in Eastern Europe can learn, the workers can learn from what the workers in Western Europe had to go through. We had to go through a very slow apprenticeship. Very slow apprenticeship indeed. In terms of socialism, the apprenticeship is so slow that it's painful. In terms of, there is a second reason, and that is that there is no room for Eastern Europe within the world market. One of the greatest illusions, and it was put by economists from Oxford and Cambridge and the London School of Economics, as we call them, and Harvard and Princeton and all of the other people, and they said, look, what's going to happen now is that there is going to be a massive injection of investment into Eastern Europe. What actually happened was that when you read the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal, what they said is we don't want to touch them. First of all, because we don't want to create more factories which are producing more goods, which are going to create an even greater degree of overproduction for the world market. But there's another reason, and this is a very important reason, that is with Polish workers and Hungarian workers and Czech workers are used to not working as hard as workers over here. In fact, if you talk to a Russian worker about the conditions that workers have to put up with in factories or services over here, they can't believe it. They simply can't believe it. So there is a very good tradition amongst the East European working class of saying, if we are being exploited, and we know we're being exploited, we're going to take life easy. We're going to have long tea breaks. We're going to sabotage the machinery if we want to get off for a long weekend, so the machines suddenly all break down on Friday morning. Now that's what happens. And I don't think those workers are suddenly going to change overnight. So in many respects, there is a kind of a class awareness amongst workers there, as there is here. I'm not sure that that actually comes from having read Marx, because I think most of them haven't ever read Marx. I think they've never been taught anything about Marx, largely because I think the one lesson of Marx that the rulers of those countries ever learned was that don't let the workers read Marx.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, I was most fortunate you didn't hear Alistair Bennett tell what the G7 was.
Yeah, well, after
the Nicholas, could you tell me?
Yes. The G7 is a group of the seven richest countries in the world. This was incidentally the reason why you weren't invited, if you go off. and neither was I. It's a meeting of the seven richest puppets in the world. And you might remember some years ago there was a television program called The Muppets, where they used to have these people who came on. Many of them looked actually very much like John Major, particularly the frog. Well, now they actually have got a new version of the Muppets, which is called the New World Order, and they meet. And what they do is that they pretend to make decisions. One of the most interesting things about politics, and one of the most sinister and worrying things about politics, is actually that most of the so-called political leaders do not actually ever make any decisions at all. They are made in advance, they are made by bureaucrats who nobody ever meets, nobody ever elects, nobody ever sees interviewed on television. And one of the things that was said at the time of the G7 summit, and I found it astonishing, it was actually said on the news at 10, by the leading political correspondent of ITN. And he said, well, actually, although all the politicians are here, this is really just a show for the public, because all the decisions have already been made. Now, that is rather worrying amongst the people who call themselves Democrats. And it shows you just how undemocratic it really all is. So the G7 is, however, the seven richest countries in the world, and that's why the Prime Minister of Japan was there, and the Prime Minister of Canada were there, and Bush was there, and Gorbachev wasn't there. he was the one applying to see the bank manager and not playing the role of the bank manager.
Thank you, Steve. Yes, at the back.
Yes, I feel sure that if the Tory opponent had turned up this evening, he almost certainly would have repeated the theory that is often voiced on television and newspapers by conservative economic gurus, professors and experts and the like, that something along the lines, yes, it's true that the market free enterprise system does have its ups and downs occasionally, but on the whole, it's a very good system because it ensures A, choice for the consumer, B, a regulatory system through pricing and competition, and C, ensures that the consumer has some control over his or her lifestyle and can choose, you know, what to do. And that, on the whole, the market system is the best thing that's ever been invented since sliced bread, because it, you know, on the whole, it works. On the whole, in those countries where it functions in a sort of fairly free and liberal way, with, although there have to be some reins and controls, but generally speaking, it's a beneficial system for these reasons, and should be supported for those reasons. I wonder if the speaker would like to comment on these claims, which are often repeated, regarding the benefits of the market system.
Well, it's just why the Tory didn't come, isn't it? Because he would have really been rather stern and predictable had he said all of that. But let's assume that he did come, he did say all that. And incidentally, it's an absolute disgrace that he didn't come. He was telephoned twice, he was asked to come. He was sent a letter last week reminding him to come. His coming was advice that was actually talked about more than the second coming of Jesus Christ. And he still hasn't come. And neither is Jesus Christ. And so the Conservative Party have something in common there. But let me answer what he might have said about choice. I mean, I always think that people who put these ideas need to talk to the people who are the victims of these illusions. Let me give you examples. According to the report that came out 2 months ago from the National Children's Home, 1 in 10 children of families on income support are not being fed at least once a month because their parents cannot afford to feed them. That is in Britain. That is within the so-called free market. And that is a disgrace. It is within a society which is actually locking away food so that people can't have access to it. In London and home counties alone, there is something like 5 million, I think I'm right in saying, it's a massive amount of tons of food which is locked away in warehouses so that prices can be kept up on the market. If it was released onto the market, prices would go down, profits would go down, and people would have food. That is what the market does. Now, that is not giving people choice. That is saying to people, if you are poor, you will have no choice at all. I'll give you a second example of what the free market does in relation to greater choice. At the moment, there is a record number of homeless people in this country. It used to be the case that people in the 1960s went off to India and see the world, and they came back and they said, it's appalling. There are people literally sleeping on the street. There are people literally begging in the streets. You do not now have to go to India on your year off between leaving school and going to university to be shot. You need to come to Camden Town.
Yeah,
because what you do is you walk out of the street and you actually find that there are people who have got nowhere to sleep. There are people who are being penalised because they've got nowhere to sleep, because in Britain, the freedom of choice is manifested through the Vagrancy Act, which actually now takes people to court and fines them for sleeping on the street. And if you can't pay the fine, you are then thrown into prison. And when you're thrown out of prison, you've got nowhere to sleep, so you sleep on the street, and then you're fined, and then you go back, and eventually you'll get a prison sentence because you've been taken to court so often under the Vagrancy Act. And this has happened. So girls are being pushed into prostitution. Not only girls, boys are being pushed into prostitution. And that is the freedom of choice, which is facing not a few, but in fact, we're talking about thousands and thousands of workers in this country. They want to work. They want to be creative. They probably also want to enjoy themselves. They can't. So I would say if the free market creates freedom of choice, this is not a hiccup. This is a catastrophe for the ideology of the free market. But I would point to a greater catastrophe. Let us look at the production of food within the free market. Because food is what we need in order to exist. At the moment, according to the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, 15 million children are dying every single year as a result of starvation. In fact, this year, Far more are going to die. They're talking about something like 27 or 28 million who are going to die in the course of 1991. That is something like Hiroshima every other day. Now, that isn't freedom of choice. Because you have food being thrown into the sea. You have vast warehouses full of wheat and full of rice. You have wine lakes. You have milk lakes. You have government policies where in America, farmers are paid to take vast acres of land out of cultivation. Because if it's cultivated, it will produce too much food. Prices will go down, profits will go down, people will be fed, and that is very bad for capitalism. In Europe, there is something called the set-aside policy, where farmers are actually given major income tax concessions in order to destroy food, to kill off dairy cattle. And that's not freedom of choice. That is a freedom to vandalize. That is a freedom to wreck people's lives. That is a freedom of the economic thug. Surely we have got the freedom to say we're going to take that freedom away. We're going to take the freedom away from the minority of millionaires and billionaires to say to everyone else, you're not going to have a home to live in, you're not going to have food, you're not going to be able to feed your children. That is the freedom which socialism is calling for. So that's what I would have said to him had he come. But he didn't, did he?
Thank you. Anyone I've said before?
I'd like to just add one piece of information. I live in the state of Ohio, one of the richer states in the United States, and certainly agriculturally. 20 to 25% of all children in the state of Ohio are below the poverty line, where hunger is pervasive, homelessness, the rest of it. And that is probably in a country that is the top food producer in the world, apart from what's taken out of production or cultivation.
Thank you for our contribution. Yes,
sorry to change the subject, but no one else has anything to say about this. I'd just like to hark back to your to the discussion about you said it would not be a violent struggle, that majority would win over the minority. Just simply because it is a majority. And yet you also pointed out that bullets are the weapon of the minority, and that's how they won so far. So how can this be a non-violent struggle?
I'll give you the short answer. That'll be something unique for this evening. I'm being very loquacious this evening because he isn't here. This Tory isn't here, so I'm taking his share of the speech. Otherwise, I might everyone will go away. But actually, maybe this is a counterproductive policy. Everyone will go away if I carry on speaking. But let me simply say this. The people who do the fighting for the capitalist class are not the capitalist class. The people who are out there in the Gulf War were not capitalists fighting over their oil. Bush is an oil multi-millionaire. Bush does not fight for oil. Dan Quayle. He doesn't fight for oil. I did hear there was talk of sending the Indiana National Guard out to the Gulf, but I don't think that Dan Quayle would have gone. So the reality is that wars aren't fought by the capitalists, they're fought for the capitalists.
Yeah, yeah.
So the people who actually do the dying, the people whose blood is spilled, the mothers who have to cry over their sons, or incidentally in America it's very advanced because women also have the right to be killed. And this was one few concessions to women's emancipation, which the American government made, which was during the Gulf War. They said, no, we're stopping at nothing. Women want to get killed, we're putting them in the front line. So now they were being killed as well. Let's be clear. It's the workers who do the dying. In the Gulf War in America, in the Gulf War, where did the American soldiers come from? They came out of the ghettos of South Bronx in New York. They came out of Detroit, out of Chicago, out of the recession. They were economic conscripts of war. 2/3 of the American forces fighting in the war came from non-white, black or Hispanic families in America. The majority, incidentally, of black workers in America were opposed to fighting that war. But it was our kids who were sent out to do it. In this country, you go into an army camp, you'll find a few of the clowns walking around in officers' uniforms, giving you orders. But they're not the ones who do the fighting. After all, they even sent out Prince Andrew to the Falklands War. They sent him out on the QE2, incidentally. So I also go to the Falklands War on the QE2, keep all the bars open. But the reality is, because they don't fight, they don't do the dying. The fighting, the dying, the suffering, the misery of being left without medical attention, the pain that goes on for years and years after war when you're walking around and you're psychologically ruined and you're reliant on drugs and your skin is burnt off and nobody will employ you because you haven't got an arm, you haven't got a leg. That's a working class. Now, what we are being asked is, are the working class going to do the fighting in a war, and that's what it would be, against the democratic working class majority who said, we've had enough of capitalism? Well, even accepting for one moment that the working class would do the fighting, I don't accept that. But even if there are a few workers indoctrinated enough and nationalistic enough and loyal and acquiescent enough to their masters to say, okay, we'll fight and we'll kill a democratic majority, that wouldn't last 5 minutes. Because where are they going to get the petrol from for their transport? Where are they going to get the food from to feed themselves? Where are they going to get the water from when their water supplies are cut off, when their electricity is cut off? Where are they going to get their bullets from when the workers in the munitions factory said, we're not going to produce bullets to kill our fellow workers? So you see, once the capitalist class lose this, the brains of the working class, once the brains of the working class are emancipated, they're not going to get anyone to fight their war.
Right.
Right on. Yeah. Carry on. In the struggle for power among the previous Communist Party members of the Soviet Union, the working class don't seem to have gained much knowledge. It was brought out that they'd been denied access to Marxist, to Karl Marx's philosophy. But how is it that they themselves haven't learned anything and take sides in the struggle between former Communist Party hierarchy, namely Yeltsin? Where was he when their judiciary, which he approved of, was sending their dissidents, which naturally I don't think were socialists, but nevertheless they were dissidents, and where are those judiciary now in relation to Yeltsin, who was a previous Communist Party hierarchy? And is there any truth in that even experience can produce knowledge without the injection of ideas from outside?
Well, the last point is definitely true, but in terms of what's going on inside Russia, first of all, I don't accept, actually, that most workers there are actually taking one side or the other. I think one of the things, and this is historically a part of the thinking of Russian people, maybe, you know, this is an odd generalization for socialists to make, but I think it's an accurate one. Russian people don't actually tend to trust leaders very much at all. One of the reasons for that is that for the last nearly 70 years, they've lived under leaders who they certainly couldn't ever trust. And also for generations and generations before that, they lived under the Tsars who they couldn't trust at all. So one of the things you'll find if you talk to Russians, as I have done a great deal, is that kind of faith in leaders is not one of their particularly great weaknesses. They don't have a great deal of it. They tend to be rather cynical about these things. They tend to say that they're all the same. There's an old peasant proverb in Russia which says, if you smile at your landlord and he comes to ask you for your produce, and then you stab him in the back as he walks past. And I think that's a good way of thinking about your rulers. The position of the Russian workers' effort is not, as far as I'm concerned, one where the majority of them are actually taking sides. I think that's the way it's painted. I think we've got to be extremely careful about believing what we are presented in the media, here in Britain or in America or wherever. Because what they are trying to do in Britain and in America is to actually read into Russia and the whole of Eastern Europe a sort of recreation of everything that exists here. And it's not like that. I think most Russian workers do not, certainly, I'm absolutely certain that the vast majority of not only Russian workers, but workers within the Russian Empire, do not trust Gorbachev and do not believe in perestroika. There's no doubt in my mind about that. The only place that anyone is going to cheer Gorbachev is in the West. As soon as he arrives back inside his own empire, he is hated, he is detested, and if you look at all of the lyrics of the poems, of pop songs and everything else that's written in that country, you'll find that the greatest way at the moment to write a best-selling rock lyric is to attack Gorbachev. Everyone will go out and buy it. This is the case. There are actually dolls that you can buy on the streets of Moscow and St. Petersburg, we must call it now, which are specially made so that you can take them home and crush them. This is a reasonably healthy sign. It doesn't show any great belief in what they're saying. But then there is this argument, you know, that somehow Yeltsin has got the support of large numbers of workers. Again, I don't accept that's right. I think that the same thing happens there as happens here, that workers on the whole vote against those who are currently in power. And Yeltsin is seen as being somebody different. I think that one of the things that is going to happen is that whoever is going to have the job over the next few years, and this is the job they want to do, not the job I hope that they will be allowed to do, of taking the whole of the Russian Empire into the so-called free market, are going to be hated, they're going to be detested, and they are going to fall at about 10 times the rate of the average Italian government. They are not going to last for very long. And that's why I think people like Gorbachev and Yeltsin are being given the job. They're being left in power to basically do what no one else wants to do. No one who has a long-term ambition in Russian politics is going to want to take on the job that they're doing. That's one of the reasons why Valenza was very reluctant to take power in Poland. Because he realised that he would have to preside over one of the most hated governments that there had been. He was put in the impossible position of finding that they had just got rid of one of the most hated governments that there had ever been in Poland, and he would have thought that anything would be better than that. And now, in fact, if you talk about Valenza in Poland, large numbers of people will tell you what a detestable swine he is, because he's doing everything to the Polish workers, which the previous government was doing to them. He's restricting the amount of food they can have, he's rationing vodka, he's cutting real wages through his presidential government. And he's also taken on enormous presidential powers, which are constitutionally horrific. So I don't accept that the workers are taken in by all this. I think what's worth looking at is, in fact, the workers in Poland, workers in various other countries, are deeply suspicious. They're deeply questioning. They are looking for something new. I think it's rather like the situation that people in this country are in the last century, where the working class was in its infancy, where they were questioning things, where there were not any fixed dogmas, but there was a searching around, a looking for new ideas, a hope that something might come along. Rather like the position in America at the beginning of this century, where some workers supported Henry George and his land reform movement because they thought, well, maybe that's got the answer. Some supported syndicalism, some supported this and some supported that, because they were groping for something. Rather like the position of German workers at the end of the Nazi period, where again, they were in the dark, they were inexperienced in dealing with ideas. They were looking, they were asking, they were waiting for something to come along. So what I would say to you is, don't be taken in by what you hear in the British press. What we do know is that there is massive resistance to perestroika in Russia. There is massive resistance to the old guard as well. And that the workers are looking for something. And that is why the importance of what we in the Socialist Party are saying has, and I don't make this as a sloganizing propaganda point, I assure you, has genuinely never been more important. Because what you have seen is the collapse of the old left, which had nothing basically to offer except looking towards Eastern Europe and state capitalist policies. And at the same time, you have seen the discrediting of the right. Because actually, one of the words that stinks in the nostrils of workers in the West more than any other word is the word market forces. You go and talk to people about market forces, and what you discover is that after the last 10 years of sanitizing and deodorizing and presenting the market as the most wonderful thing that ever fell down from heaven, most workers think that the market stinks. Most workers think the market doesn't serve their interests. And if you then look at that, what you discover is that the left has been shown to be bankrupt and the right has been shown to be bankrupt, and there is, and there always will be, as long as there is oppression, a desire for freedom. And that is why the socialist proposition of democratic political organization whereby we create a society of production for use is the most important and exciting proposition of our time. Because in a sense, the road is clear for socialist ideas. The phony socialists have been discredited. The people with the magic of the market have been shown that their magic is a pernicious poison. Socialism is on the agenda. So the concluding point we want to leave you with after this meeting refers back to what I said at the very beginning, that for years and years and years, the Communist Party were always there saying, look over to Russia, there is paradise. And the Conservatives were always saying, but look to the West, if only we can have a free market, if only we can privatise industries, if only we can have hospitals which opt out of the National Health Service and are run on the basis of getting sponsorship, if only we can turn everything into a money-making concern, then people will be really free. Both of these strategies have been shown not only to fail, but to fail lamentably. Socialism is on the agenda. Socialism is the answer which we can put forward. And this party has a record which we've a right to be proud about, because we were never taken in by either of those strategies. And that's why, in these coming months and these coming years, in what I claim are the most momentous times we've seen this century, you should be active and working within the Socialist Party to help us get these ideas across. That's what we ask the people here. Thank you.